Dismantling DEI. Florida is on the verge of banning cities and counties from funding, carrying out, and even promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, March 26, 2026. There's growing concern over a bill Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to sign that, beginning January 1st, would prohibit cities and counties from paying for or promoting DEI programs. Both the state Senate and House passed the legislation earlier this month. The votes were mostly along party lines, with five House Republicans and one Senate Republican joining Democrats in voting no. The legislation defines DEI as an effort to have programs or give preferential treatment based on race, color, sex, ethnicity, gender identity, or sexual orientation. Bill sponsor, Jacksonville Republican Representative Dean Black, spoke to lawmakers about the measure the day it passed in the House on March 10th.
Not only have millions and millions of taxpayer dollars been wasted in the name of DEI, this philosophy has fostered resentment instead of goodwill, mediocrity instead of merit, and it has divided our society against itself. In recognition of this, over preceding years, we have worked to reunify our people once again by destroying DEI philosophy in K-12 education, our university system, our state, and now our federal governments. But members, we still have work to do.
The bill prohibits local governments from taking official actions related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Municipalities cannot create or support DEI offices or hire DEI officers, and no public funds can be used to promote initiatives. Contract or grant recipients must agree that they won't use that money for DEI-related training or materials. Any county or city official who violates the rules could be removed from office by the governor, and residents could take their local government to court. In terms of what local governments can still do despite the restrictions, they may recognize or promote federal and state holidays, patriotic and national observances. People or groups can be honored with memorials, monuments, or museums. Local governments must follow state and federal laws, including anti-discrimination rules. This bill could have real impacts on some Central Florida nonprofits that rely on local funding and support. Come Out with Pride Orlando's mission is to create welcoming and accessible events and support the LGBTQIA+ community. The nonprofit's annual festival and parade draw more than 200,000 people downtown. Executive Director Tatiana Quiroga explains how the bill banning DEI could affect her organization and the community.
Seeing this bill, I have to say part of me wasn't surprised, but at the same time, as a longtime resident of Florida, you know, my wife and I have two children, this place is home, and it's very disappointing and disheartening and extremely hurtful. And I think that as a tiny 501c3 nonprofit, Come Out with Pride, we're basically run by volunteers. I'm literally the only paid staffer. So to have a bill that comes across really limiting the support from the city and the county to organizations such as ours is pretty detrimental. We receive a grant from the city of Orlando through the Downtown Development Board, basically supporting downtown businesses and initiatives. We really rely on this $20,000 grant. We obviously bring quite a bit of an economical impact and also a cultural impact. So to see that we're contributing so much to the local economy and see suddenly this restriction happening to the cities and to the state level will definitely impact us.
Have you heard from the Orlando Downtown Development Board about the $20,000 sponsorship?
I have not. And that's kind of where I actually am checking my email almost every day because I should have heard by now. I submitted my application just like I have over the last 5+ years, and I feel like the ball is in their court.
Have you thought about ways you may have to change your strategy or your approach in speaking to previous financial sponsors or maybe people confused about what they can or can't do or show support?
I really was very intentional when putting together our sponsorship packets this year, very much laying out the work that we do as an organization and the importance of pride. That yes, we put on an incredible party. The parade is so much fun. People dress up, you know, all these wonderful things. And it is a huge celebration of authenticity and love. And it's more than just a party. That people don't look at us and say, okay, a party is going to save a life. But pride can. If this is the first time that somebody actually shows up in public as their authentic self, that's huge. If somebody actually uses their name, the name that they want to go by, or that it is their real name, that's huge. You know, statistics will show us that those are life-saving things that happen. So that's where talking to the sponsors this year, I am very intentional of making sure that they get the message that yes, we throw an incredible party, but it's really much bigger than a party, that these are things that are essential for our communities. I really want, you know, allies and especially our sponsors to understand that, you know, these are the critical times for them to show up, not just for the community, but also for their employees, that these are the times where the employees need to make sure that, you know, their companies are being supportive of them.
A part of this is affinity groups. These are the voluntary groups like LGBTQ+ employee groups, women in STEM, mm-hmm. Black or Latino resource groups, groups for people with disabilities or for veterans, for example. Can you speak to what you're seeing with how they're affected and how that impacts your organization?
Most definitely. That is actually a direct impact because there's a lot of misunderstanding of who funds come out with Pride. And so you look at our sponsor list and you see large, you know, national, international corporations on whose logos are on our page. And yes, we receive their support, but we receive their support at the ERG level. So it's local folks that are in these resource groups that live here in Central Florida who are using the budgets that they get from these large corporations to then, you know, support and be able to participate in Pride. So seeing large corporations basically erase these groups completely from their offerings and their support of their employees has been happening left and right. It breaks my heart for these employees and for these staffers and even cast members, because I can't imagine what it would feel like to be part of a company that you are dedicated to and you're putting your time and effort into something, and you were seen as a person, you were encouraged to show up as your whole self. So you're not just there from 8 to 5, you are showing up, you know, as a person of color or somebody with a disability, invisible disability, all these different things, like you were saying, and then suddenly now that's completely erased and you're being told to basically go back in the corner, go back in the closet, you know, what have you. From our point of view, as the nonprofit, we've had our funding cut because of these groups have disappeared.
So under the DEI bill, local government officials can't promote or show support for DEI initiatives. What impact would that have on Come Out with Pride and LGBTQ+ residents here?
Directly speaking for Come Out with Pride in the Central Florida LGBTQ+ community, one of the things that we are so excited about and grateful for and look forward to is the city streets. Right before Pride, about a week or two, the city of Orlando puts up our rainbow banners. And that is really a true representation of the progress that we have made, the progress that we've made as an LGBTQ+ movement and community, and also the progress the city of Orlando has made. And that helps get everybody excited, you know, like the buzz is in the air. It's also a moment of visibility and representation. And we know that those two things are so critical to marginalized communities. It really is absolutely essential for marginalized communities to be able to see themselves on a larger platform and a larger stage. And so to know that this year that may not be happening, especially the 10th Remembrance of Pulse, is quite a slap in the face. You know, I do think that unfortunately it took the Pulse tragedy to move the conversation along here in Central Florida. And we do have the relationship that we have in the community, support that we have because Pulse happens. And so to know that the same thing is happening the year of a 10th year of remembrance of Pulse, it really is, again, not just disheartening and sad, but it is really a slap in the face.
Supporters of this bill argue it ensures equal opportunities for everyone. How do you respond to that argument that DEI programs give some people an unfair advantage?
I would like to know exactly what they're referring to, because again, thinking about the city's support, I don't get a discount. The city had very specifically said to me, despite you being the largest single day event, despite the economic and cultural impact that you bring, we don't get a discount. We apply for that grant just like everybody else does every single year. And so we don't get any special support or accommodations. I already look at the system that we have at hand as equitable. I'm very interested to see how this bill is then going to affect other celebrations that are not just LGBTQ+. What does the Veterans Day parade going to look like? What does happen with the Puerto Rican Day parade here in Orlando or the MLK? You know, like what happens to those other festivals? Because yes, DEI does include the LGBTQ+ community, but we're whole people. So then we live in these intersections and, you know, we are amongst a larger group of marginalized communities. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when people's St. Patrick's Day parade gets affected or the celebration isn't quite what it used to be, and see how people suddenly start realizing that things that they value so much may end up be considering DEI, and that they're going to be impacted also.
Will Come Out With Pride be able to continue if this DEI bill becomes law?
100%. 100%. We don't see it as an option whatsoever to ever cancel or reschedule. And I know that other prides have done that and have cited the current climate as their reason for canceling or rescheduling. And to us, that is not an option. If anything, this motivates us to fight harder. We recognize that celebrating pride does not have to be a fireworks show. It doesn't have to be two huge entertainment stages. It doesn't have to be this massive production. The spirit of pride is being able to bring the community together, to recognize who we are, for folks to realize that they are not alone, which really can be life-saving for members of our community.
That was Come Out With Pride Executive Director Tatiana Quiroga. I reached out to the City of Orlando about the $20,000 grant from the Downtown Development Board. A spokesperson confirms that Come Out With Pride submitted an application and says the Special Events Committee will meet next week on April 3rd to review and finalize awarded amounts. Those in favor of the DEI ban say it prevents taxpayer money from being used for divisive programs. Conservative policy advocate and president of Liberty Council Action, John Stemberger, is based in Orlando and explains his support for the legislation.
The purpose of city and county government is to concern themselves with roads, emergency services, public safety, and to divert funding to go to have administrative offices or DEI directors and engage in political and social engineering is not the function of a taxpayer dollar. The vast majority of taxpayers, according to polling, do not want to see this kind of policy. You know, businesses want to operate with uniformity throughout the state. So when every county has a different policy on whatever, it's very difficult to operate. So I think the legislature is correct in preempting this and requiring cities and counties to basically use merit. Why in the world would we want to hire someone who's not the best? Why we want to hire someone based upon external factors like their skin color or their perceived gender identity or something like that, or age? So we need to pick the best people. It's just good public policy all the way around. We shouldn't treat people differently because they're in a different category. We should treat people equally based upon their merit.
How do you define DEI?
Well, it wasn't my term, but it's diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's intended to basically identify people and give them an advantage based upon basically reverse discrimination. I mean, we don't solve past discrimination with present discrimination. And that's what basically DEI does. Is it favors people not based upon their merit or their qualifications, but based upon some external category that they may be in.
What are some examples of what you feel to be inappropriate spending of public dollars on DEI activities?
Yeah, all over the state, particularly in more blue counties, you have DEI officers that are hired at quite a large salary to basically promote this behavior, promote this kind of hiring practice and this culture within cities and counties. It also happens, especially in universities. I think that's does not come under the purview of this particular bill. But again, it's just not needed. And it produces a poor result. You don't have the best people. You're actually hiring people just for diversity's sake. I mean, you want diversity, I think, but it should be natural. There has to be ways we can do this other than just promoting it in DEI.
Should this include funding or participation in something like a San Junipero Festival, Pulaski Day Parade, St. Patrick's Day Parade?
No, I don't think that the bill really covers that. It's not intended to, you know, so there's some ethnic celebration for some Italian thing or Irish thing or Black, you know, month in February, Black American Week, whatever. I don't think that comes under the purview of the bill. And let me just say this out of fairness. I do think there are times where it is good public policy. Let's say, for instance, police force. If you live in a high Latino area, high Black area, you do want people that look and sound like. So I think there is some compelling reason in some instances to have specific, but there's a reason for it. There's a specific policy reason. So you get the best possible person and you can produce a better result empirically because that person's relating to those people. But just to hire someone generically, right, for a generic job where there's no policy reason behind the fact that they're Black or Latino or gay or whatever it is, if you can show a reason why it makes sense, right, from a policy reason, that they can do a better job, then it makes sense. But to just hire generic employees, let's say as administrators, as, you know, typists, you know, whatever, administrative kinds of jobs or even policy jobs, it doesn't make any sense from that standpoint.
So far, we've talked about the financial component, the hiring, using state or local money to fund certain things. This also includes showing support for these initiatives. And we've heard elected officials say this law would preclude them from participating in something like a pride parade in their official capacity. Do you see that as an overreach? Is that a problem?
No, I don't think that's a problem at all. And I don't think the bill doesn't go to that. So people can exercise their First Amendment rights, again, not using taxpayer funding. If they want to participate and the right to speak freely or associate with groups, that's not within the purview of the bill. So I don't see there's any First Amendment issues that the bill triggers.
How does someone know that? How would a local official know what crosses the line, what is and isn't allowed?
Well, you can interpret the statute. It's fairly clear. You could also have your lawyers look at it. Eventually, this might be challenged in courts. I suspect that, you know, it's going to be upheld. The legislature does have the constitutional right to preempt the home rule of a local county or a city. And that's what they've chosen to do here, to create a uniform policy so that businesses know what the rules to the game are and everyone else knows as well.
Critics say that this limits how communities can acknowledge racial or cultural history. What's your response to that concern?
No, not at all. I mean, we have Black History Month. You know, they have various celebrations, the anniversary of Pulse. That's very different than hiring. We're talking about hiring people, right? Hiring people or creating officers to promote this kind of thing. We don't need that. You can just do that. You don't need an officer and public policy to do that.
What do you think the takeaway is? What do you want people to understand about the bill? Those who are worried, you know, their community events are going to disappear because people are afraid to show support.
It's not going to happen. I mean, basically, government shouldn't favor or disadvantage people based upon their age, race, or gender. The law should treat everyone equally and not sort people in different groups and then give them favor because they're in that group. And that's why the bill is good public policy.
John Stemberger is president of Liberty Council Action based in Orlando. This bill does include some carve-outs. For example, Black History Month is recognized in Florida law as a state observance, which means local governments can promote it. There are many questions about what is and is not allowed should this DEI ban become law. Rollins College political science assistant professor Patrick Rickert talks about the implications of the legislation.
A lot of the things that this bill does reaffirm some laws that are already in place. The parts of the law that are trying to prevent manipulating or influencing the composition of employees with regard to race, color, sex, ethnicity, or gender already falls under a lot of the non-discrimination prohibitions that are in place. Really, what this is aimed at is some of the initiatives and programming that local governments, cities, and counties have been doing to promote diversity or highlight the LGBTQ communities. A couple of months ago, Florida's Department of Government Efficiency put out a report about waste in city and county governments. And the real thing that it identified as waste were these DEI programs that some in the governor's office have said were already illegal.
Who decides what groups fall into DEI?
The law has three different definitions of DEI, and the groups that are listed are, and I'm quoting right now, groups based on a person or a group's race, color, sex, ethnicity, gender identity, or sexual orientation. But opponents of the bill have argued that as a whole, the bill is very broad and too broad to properly or consistently enforce.
Who would interpret what supporting DEI looks like in terms of what this bill doesn't allow moving forward?
Yeah, there are two mechanisms that the bill puts into place. One is that a citizen can bring action against a local elected official that they are alleging violated this law, at which point it would be determined by the courts. The law also says that anyone who violates one of these policies has committed malfeasance. And under Florida law, the governor has the discretion to suspend and potentially remove any local elected official who has committed malfeasance. So this could lead to the governor having some increased authority to punish local elected officials who engage in these practices.
So could an elected official participate in a pride parade or a veterans parade or a Lunar New Year celebration or maybe a St. Patrick's Day parade then?
There's, I would say, still debate about that. So House Speaker Daniel Perez specifically said that the language in this bill wouldn't prevent cities from doing things like holding pride festivals, but the statutory language is really open to interpretation. So something like a St. Patrick's Day parade, which is programming this designed specifically with reference to Irish heritage, seems to fall under the prohibition against ethnicity. There are a few carve-outs across the bill, allowing cities to celebrate state or federal holidays or groups honored by national or state memorials, which is the provision that protects the Pulse Memorial here in Orlando being built. But those also open their own range of interpretation. How do we define which groups in particular are being honored by different memorials?
It sounds like there's a lot of gray area here.
Yeah, and that is the main objection that opponents of the bill raised when it was being debated. This is kind of an interesting bill in that it didn't pass on a party line vote. There were five Republicans in the Florida House and one in the Senate that had reservations that this bill was too ambiguous. People who opposed the bill have pointed out things like grants given to organizations like the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce might be impacted by this. And so community partners that prioritize some particular group would be ineligible for these grants and thus have to curtail their activities, which are things that are important to the people living in the city. The citizens of the city voted for the city government to do the things that it is doing.
Are there any aspects of public service that are protected by First Amendment rights to free speech? Could an elected official argue it is their right to show support in a parade, for example?
Free speech protections under the Constitution get a little bit trickier when you are talking about things that are part of one's professional political duty as an elected official versus their own conduct as a private citizen. For instance, an elected official could argue that they are being part of this parade in their capacity as a private citizen, not in their capacity as mayor, for instance. But again, that would be something subject to the courts or the governor's discretion over whether that was actually in their professional capacity.
When we're looking at gray areas, how do you define whether something is DEI programming or cultural programming?
To a certain extent, I don't know that there is much of a clear, meaningful distinction. If we consider culture as something to be the outgrowth of race or ethnicity or gender identity, well, that would fall under the definition of DEI that the law has.
Who's benefiting from this bill being passed?
I think this is part of a larger effort on the part of the governor's office and the supermajority in the Florida legislature to impose the will of the state government over these cities that are maybe doing things that the governor or many in the state legislature disagree with.
Are there legal questions about this bill that could lead to lawsuits?
There will be a lot of lawsuits, especially if elected officials are removed. Certainly they would have standing to sue that there wasn't necessarily a due process followed or a fair process allowing them to challenge their removal. Groups may be disproportionately impacted by the removal of some of these programs or the non-renewal of some contracts might try to sue to stop the bill as well. And city governments as a whole may argue that this violates home rule and impermissibly takes power away from the municipal governments. Florida's statutes say that the municipal governments have broad powers to govern within their own jurisdictions, but it also says subject to state law. So the state government does have the ability to preempt some of that home rule. And under the American constitutional system, cities and counties are creatures of the state. They only have power to the extent that the state allows them to. And so states can curtail this home rule, as they are attempting to do here.
Patrick Rickard is assistant professor of political science at Rollins College in Winter Park. I want to thank everyone who shared their thoughts about this DEI bill with us here at Central Florida Public Media. Judy Nkoko writes, "This executive order promotes whites-only culture, wealth inequality, and excludes anyone of a different race or ethnicity. It rejects every value that has made America great." Maria writes, "If in the United States there had not been slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, institutional racism in housing, education, employment, there would be no necessity for DEI." We always appreciate hearing from you. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org to help us shape the conversations on Engage. The astronauts on NASA's first crewed flight to the moon in more than 50 years arrive at the Kennedy Space Center tomorrow. Next on Engage, how the events happening on our space coast are laying the foundation for living on the lunar surface sooner rather than later. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so every episode is sent right to you.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Coming up, a centennial celebration where some of Central Florida's youngest stars shine on stage. First, the first crewed mission to the moon in decades is closer to lifting off from our space coast. NASA just revealed changes to the Artemis program and lunar plans this week. We're joined now by Brendan Byrne, Central Florida Public Media's assistant news director and host of the Are We There Yet podcast. Thanks for being here, Brendan.
Great to be here, Sharon.
Let me start big picture with you. What is actually changing with Artemis right now?
A lot. Okay. So there were some really, really big changes announced this week. We had heard earlier that NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman was changing an Artemis mission to get us closer to the moon faster and make these launches happen more frequently. But he's actually kind of flipped the entire script as to how we are going to sustain human presence on the moon. Before, The plans for NASA was to have a tiny little space station orbiting the moon in this really weird orbit where we would send landers to there, and then we would send astronauts there, and they would transfer, and then they would go down to lunar surface. Mm-hmm. Isaacman scrapped that idea and said, instead, we are going to build a permanent base on the lunar surface. That will happen in steps, but by the next decade, we will have astronauts regularly on the moon if all goes to plan.
That is a lot of changes.
It was a change announced at NASA's headquarters touting President Trump's space policy. And Jared Isaacman, NASA administrator, called this the Ignite program. And that is essentially what it is. It is igniting pretty much all aspects of NASA to change course and build on this big, ambitious idea to have a permanent presence on the lunar surface.
Okay, so we've got this new direction. Instead of orbiting the moon with a space station, NASA leadership is talking about having people actually on the moon. Why? What's behind the change?
So Isaacman has taken a hard look at how NASA does business, and he has said that it's not an issue where NASA is underfunded. It's just that those funds are not spent appropriately, or we waste a lot of money on missions that go nowhere. We're talking about the SLS program, right? Billions and billions of dollars to launch people to the moon, and we've only launched one of those rockets so far. So he says by changing the way that we spend money, putting more focus on having commercial partners with NASA help building things, we can get there a little bit better. It is going to cost a lot of money. Here's what he had to say about when we'll have the moon base and how much it's going to cost.
The moon base will not appear overnight. We will invest approximately $20 billion over the next 7 years and build it through dozens of missions, working together with commercial and international partners towards a deliberate and achievable plan.
So $20 billion over the next decade or so, lots and lots of money that's going to be spent towards this. But he thinks that by moving the money around, it can happen.
And before any of this happens, Brendan, Artemis II actually has to launch. Where do things stand?
Yeah, so Artemis II right now is, as you know, Sharon, it was at the launch pad. They had a very successful fueling test. Then right after that, they had an issue with a helium system on the upper stage of the rocket. It was pulled back into the hangar, the vehicle assembly building. Those repairs were made. They did some more maintenance on it. It was rolled back out again. Right now, all signs are pointing to NASA trying to launch in the April window. There are a number of dates where they can launch beginning April 1st, and they are still targeting that date for launch from Kennedy Space Center.
We're talking with Brendan Byrne, host of our Are We There Yet podcast on Central Florida Public Media, about the Artemis program. So this mission to send people to the moon for the first time in more than 50 years, it sounds so exciting, but it's not without risk. Is NASA confident the mission's ready to go?
When you hear from NASA leaders, they will say, we will not launch until we are ready. Safety is a number one concern. It's always on front of mind. The agency has had 3 missions that have ended with the loss of human lives, mm-hmm. right? The Apollo 1 fire and Columbia and Challenger space shuttle accidents. So they are always thinking about that. But when they talk about Artemis II, they are always talking that this is a flight test. There is inherent risk in sending humans to the moon for the first time in a spacecraft that has never carried humans before, using systems that have never been tested before. And there are also some risks with the actual vehicle that we know. On the uncrewed flight that happened a few years ago, there were issues with the heat shield that protects the capsule on its way back in. They are using a different way to come into the atmosphere on their way back. So there's a risk there with a new way of coming into the atmosphere. So there's a lot of things that could go wrong with this mission. And it's being sold to the American public is that this is a test mission. But NASA has done everything in their power to make sure all of those risks are mitigated to as much as they can. But space is hard, and we know this is a brand new system.
So assuming this mission is a success and all the goals you outlined for us, what is the next step?
So after this, we will have Artemis III, which will practice rendezvousing with whatever the lunar lander is going to be. That's going to take humans to the moon by Artemis 4. Artemis 5 will happen after that. We'll send more humans to the moon. And then NASA leadership said this week that they want to have commercial companies launch those later Artemis missions so that NASA is only paying for seats on those, much like they do for rides to the International Space Station. While all of this is happening, they're going to be building that lunar base, Sharon. They are going to be sending rovers. They're going to be sending payloads there. They want to have this lunar base by the 2030s because essentially it is going to act as our place to do science, much like the International Space Station. So Jared Isaacman and NASA want to have 4 astronauts on the surface of the moon every 4 months.
Okay, so Brendan, some of these challenges are more relatable than others for those of us here on Earth. I'm thinking about having water and a usable toilet. I'm thinking you'd want both of those for any trip, no matter where you're going.
That's right, you would. And that is a priority for Artemis 2. They will be flying the first lunar toilet. It's a part of the Orion spacecraft, and they've got to test it out. Here's pilot Victor Glover talking about how that process is actually going to happen.
We're going to get a couple of us out of our seats and start to check out really critical systems, the water system and the toilet.
Very important.
Got to have a toilet to go to the moon. And so we're going to be working as a team and working with Mission Control to make sure that the vehicle is ready.
And yes, that's a critical part of the life support system of this mission. So all eyes will be on the Artemis 2 crew, and I will be watching the Artemis 2 toilet.
I feel like we can't go anywhere else from there that we need to wrap on that.
Yes. Always end on with a flush, right?
Yes. Central Florida Public Media Assistant News Director and host of the Are We There Yet podcast, Brendan Byrne. Thank you.
Anytime, Sharon.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. The Orlando Family Stage has been a fixture in the Central Florida community for 100 years, providing a cultural outlet for residents, including ambitious young performers. Notable alumni of the company include pop star and actress Mandy Moore, Broadway legend Norm Lewis, and Delta Burke of Designing Women fame. The centennial of Orlando Family Stage's founding will be celebrated next Thursday, April 2nd, in the Steinmetz Hall at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts. The event is being presented as part of UCF Celebrates the Arts, an annual performance festival highlighting the talents of UCF faculty and students, as well as that of the Central Florida community. The event also acknowledges a deep partnership between the Orlando Family Stage and the University of Central Florida, one that creates connections to the university's Master of Fine Arts program, as well as outreach to schools and aspiring actors facing barriers to education and the stage. Thursday's event will include a variety of performances, including cameos from Moore, Burke, as well as comedy from Mad TV alum Paul Vogt, and Emmy Award-winning Leslie Carrera Rudolph, a veteran of Sesame Street. Chris Brown is the executive director of Orlando Family Stage. Jeff Moore is the dean of UCF School of Performing Arts. They both join us to talk about the role the stage plays in the Central Florida community and the opportunities provided by the partnership between the Family Stage and the university.
This organization has been in our community for 100 years as of February 3rd. Last month, we marked the official centennial by anchoring it to the organization's very first performances in town. And so those very first performances in 1926 took place at the Beecham, and the Beecham's still downtown today. And they were a little nomadic, but the community that was at that point only 30,000 residents thought that it was very important to have a theater, and it was very important to have kids involved in that. And so, you know, the organization has evolved through many iterations over 100 years, as I think any company would. And they have always really been there for a resource for the community. And I think that's what it was all the way back then, and that's what it still continues to be.
So this is a theater company that has lived through a lot of history. Is that reflected in its programming?
Absolutely. I think the theater is really a great vehicle for not only unpacking just storytelling in general, but to bring in those historical stories and make sure that we're learning from the past. It's a very excellent medium for telling a story and having conversations about it. And that sort of interaction and that community that you build through that process is absolutely at the root and the foundation of what we do every single day here.
In 2000, the theater partnered with UCF and became the Orlando Repertory Theater. Dean Jeff Moore, can you just talk about that partnership?
Sure. It was really fortuitous. City of Orlando had, of course, the Civic Auditorium building in Lock Haven Park, where the Orlando Museum of Art is located. They had an old Science Center building that was replaced with the new Science Center. And they had these buildings, and we really wanted to revitalize that area. So President John Hitt, UCF at the time, and Orlando Mayor Glenda Hood at the time, brainstormed and said, boy, it would be great to bring theater back into the Civic Building and to really nurture it in a way to revitalize Lock Haven Park. And we were able to envision the Orlando Shakes Theater in the old Orlando Science Center building, and then in the old Civic Building, to have the Orlando Repertory Theater. And what will the Orlando Repertory Theater have? How will we be unique? And through great community members who helped lead the way, UCF brought some people in who helped brainstorm this whole idea to focus the programming of the Orlando Rep at the time into Theater for Young Audiences, or TYA. And this tied into UCF's academic offerings for a Master of Fine Arts in Theater for Young Audiences, a very specific specialization. Very unique. It's the only dedicated TYA theater in the state of Florida.
Yes, isn't that interesting, Jeff, that we are now the stewards of this? We weren't in the picture or in the conversation when all of these ideas were generated, but what an amazing thing that it's grown into, and now we get to continue to lead it. It's pretty cool.
Sure is. It's an awesome responsibility, but a very rewarding opportunity.
Absolutely.
Chris, you called this a resource in the community. I'm wondering, were you talking about the performance or other programs, community programs, like you have in-class school workshops?
Yes, that's the answer.
Yes. There's an interesting thing to unpack, especially with this institution in Central Florida. You know, we are in the middle of an entertainment capital of the world, right? So we have more entertainment in our town and more arts institutions and all kinds of arts and culture organizations. Orlando Family Stage is very, very nuanced in this. And what we have found with dedicating our work to children and young people over these last 25 years is, you know, all of that experience has really prepared us for the world that our young people are in today. Whether it's the U.S. Surgeon General stating that we have a loneliness epidemic, or whether we're talking about youth mental health challenges and the things that kids are really struggling with through elementary, middle, and high school, we are here to support and be a resource for all of those young people and families. Yes, we are a place that provides some level of entertainment on the easiest surface level. You can come here as a family on a Saturday afternoon and see a show, and that's great. But if you peel back some of those layers, you can very quickly find the depth in our work and the very nuanced rigor that we provide in our programs. And that really ties us back to our wonderful partnership with Dean Moore in the college. Like, this partnership isn't a traditional just kind of taking resources from the university. We are both benefiting dramatically from this, whether it's new students or students getting in front of the community, or the community seeing our students grow and then attend UCF. The young people in 2026 really desperately need places where they feel like they belong, and they need places where they feel like they can grow and build connections with each other. We live in a very isolated world, and the theater is such a unique medium to bring people together. And might be on a team, right, where they are working and collaborating with their peers to produce a show, but it might also be just unpacking and discussing loneliness and depression in my high school classroom. There's so many different levels that we really try to move the needle on things that matter in their world. That's really what we're here for.
So some very notable names have passed through. Wayne Brady, Mandy Moore, Delta Burke of Designing Women fame. And that kind of brings us to the Centennial Celebration Concert on April 2nd. To both of you, can you just talk about the program and maybe some of the alumni we'll hear from?
Well, you definitely gather alumni when you've been around for 100 years. And obviously, we're not able to connect with the very early organization in the 20s and 30s and 40s, but we are taking the theme park approach to our centennial. And all year long, we're celebrating our 100-year milestone. And so what that has done, it has led us down many roads through the archives and bubbling up people that grew up here, people that spent decades here doing theater and creating art. And one of the just most exciting events is our centennial celebration concert. And you're right, it's pretty incredible the talent that has come through Central Florida. You have the very recognizable names like the Mandy Moores and the Wayne Bradys, and they will both be involved in the concert. We've gotten about, I would say, a dozen stars to come here and perform live. And then we will also have video and welcomes from some of the other stars that couldn't make it here with their schedule. But yes, Delta Burke, for those 70s and 80s Designing Women fans, Mandy Moore, Norm Lewis, Josh Segarra, who is on a new show right now on Netflix, I believe, Best Medicine. We've got Paul Vogt, who's been on Mad TV and Hairspray on Broadway in Chicago. We have Davis Gaines coming in, who is the longest running Phantom of Phantom of the Opera on Broadway. We have some younger talent that graduated, I would say, within the last 10 years, like Sophia Delure, who was in The Prom movie and Stereophonic on Broadway. And then we also have people like Leslie Carrera Rudolph, who just won her third Emmy for being the voice of Abby Cadabby on Sesame Street. And I could keep going on, though the list is quite fun. And we're going to have a great evening on April 2nd.
Can you also talk about just that feeling of seeing faces that have passed through the company on the screen, or when you hear the voices in animation or gaming?
You know, I don't know that I could bring words to that experience of seeing a young person come into the program and they're probably timid, they're probably shy, they're probably holding onto their parents' arms and really looking for permission. And then just a short time later, you see them come out of their shell. And I mean, I can't even count the number of summers where students have just exploded on our stages. And their parents are like, who is this child? You know, there's something to be said for a child spending 8 to 10 hours in rehearsal and then getting in that car to leave rehearsal and talking 90 miles an hour because of all the excitement that they just spent from that 8-hour session. But that's the experience. And so to see, yes, the students that pursue this as a career and go on to be in the entertainment industry is quite wonderful. But truthfully, you can see those kids right when you see them for the very first time. They have that sort of spark. So to me, I love even more all of the kids that come through that become doctors and lawyers and accountants and all of these students that are just 100% more confident to speak, 100% more confident in making eye contact with people and being confident with who they are. And that's what we see over and over and over and over again at Orlando Family Stage. And I know that Dean Moore sees that from his chair as well, right? As these students grow up and maybe they're in the college courses.
Certainly. I mean, it's been very rewarding to watch people who had their start at the Orlando Family Stage. You know, the goal of education for me is to help people understand better something that they're interested in, and then seeing where that leads them. And wherever it leads them, as long as they're successful and happy, it is so rewarding to see that kind of fulfillment. And then it makes you motivated to get up the next morning and say, I've got to do it again, because there's a new class of people coming in.
That's
and
great.
They all deserve that same opportunity. You know, UCF is very proud of being in the Central Florida community, but it's more important for us to be of the Central Florida community. And when I see our great alumni and I see our great faculty who have impact on these students and these participants in the Orlando Family Stage, for example, it really makes it worth it. It is just a full circle moment. It's wonderful.
Chris Brown is the executive director of Orlando Family Stage. Jeff Moore is the dean of UCF School of Performing Arts. The Centennial Celebration Concert takes place next Thursday, April 2nd, at the Steinmetz Hall in the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts. We have more information on our website, cfpublic.org. That's all for this week's edition of Engage. We are working on a segment, and we'd like to hear from you. How are increased oil and fuel prices impacting you in ways people may not realize? Let us know. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org or send a talkback on the Central Florida Public Media app. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.